Welcome to Business Watch. In the wake of the recent KZN floods and the continued slow-burning debate about South Africa's just energy transition, the 1st of June is a good day to assess how South Africa is delivering on its promises in respect of climate change as we are just over halfway to COP27, Africa's COP. Egypt is going to host COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in November, and the talks will take place in the shadow, obviously globally, of the war in Ukraine, as well as rising energy and food prices around the world, leaving rich countries grappling with the cost of living crisis and poor countries struggling with debt mountains. Financial assistance for developing countries must be at the top of the agenda for the UN climate talks this year, and that's certainly what the host country Egypt says and has made clear, as governments are going to be required to follow through on promises made at the COP26 summit last year in Glasgow. Now, most of the world's biggest economies and biggest emitters of greenhouse gases have yet to fulfill the pledges that they made at Glasgow last November to strengthen their targets on emission cuts and work to turn the pledges of climate finance from rich countries into projects on the ground, helping poor countries, have been slow. But how is South Africa doing? Well, let's welcome our panel to find out. Justine Sweet from Herbert Smith Freehills, Olivia Rumble, Director of Climate Legal, and colleague Andrew Gilder, also Director of Climate Legal. As always, great to have you around the table. Justine, the report that you've just released as Herbert Smith Freehills really offers a snapshot view of how governments' ambitions and promises in respect of climate change 6 months after that critical Glasgow conference are faring. It's commonly referred to as the last best chance that humanity has here. What are some of the headline findings from this report?
So I think the sad headline finding is that we're not really making a huge amount of progress. What I think is important to understand is that the EU and the UK are still leading the way from a climate change ambition perspective, but it doesn't mean that they're taking adequate steps. In our kind of main conclusion is really that the need for collaborative global action is more apparent than ever before, and we now need business to take action. We must think about perhaps unique policy drivers as a mechanism, and I'm talking about this more of a global problem than simply a South African problem, and I think Olivia and Andrew would both agree with me. I think from my perspective, I would like to see industry and business playing a greater role. We can look at industry standards as a measure to push, and then we have government to sort of play catch up. And I think that the climate change bill, which Olivia and Andrew can both speak to much better than I can, is a prime example. I mean, I remember sitting in a room with Andrew and government and industry in 2016, and the intention was to get that bill out in by the end of the year, and we are now in 2022, and the next round of sort of comments and things like that is upon us. Yeah. So these things are all taking place very slowly, and I'm afraid that the report that we've released says exactly the same thing in the 6 months post COP26.
It really is very sobering. We're still on track for 2.4 degree warming, let alone keeping it below 1.5 degrees, and we know the impacts on Africa and poor and developing countries in particular are outsized here. We need a sense of urgency to be dealing with this as the existential threat that it is to humanity. I just want to build on that, Andrew, and you know, you've been involved in this process for some time. I think a healthy degree of skepticism sometimes can get things moving a little bit, but have we become a little bit too bogged down? Is there a lack of urgency from a South African perspective, or are you seeing the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment moving in the opposite direction to some of its cabinet colleagues here? And I say that because the Minister, Barbara Creasy, certainly has a great deal of energy when it comes to climate change.
So, I mean, Michael, it's an interesting one. I think what's happened to everybody involved in preparing to govern climate change, because we're still preparing to govern climate change. I think that the science, the urgency of the science has kind of almost overtaken the political processes. Let's be clear. The science was always more urgent than the political process. I always found rather amusing the fact that while the science told us that last decade was the decade within which we had to start making very significant cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, the politics parked dealing with the problem until the end of the decade, 2020. Mm. That process is about 8 years ago now, the science that told us that the last decade was urgent. And so the science has almost become screamingly urgent, but the politics remains as the politics always has. And we are faced with a rather curious scenario in this country where government itself seems to be internally divided on how to deal with these things. So we were very fortunate to play a significant role in the drafting of the climate change bill, and we feel very proud that legislation, you know, hopefully is about to take shape as an act. But that doesn't take away from the situation where you have environmental affairs saying one thing, making commitments at the international level, and the DMRE saying diametrically opposite things. I don't know how to solve that.
I'm just
a consultant.
As we know, I think the Minister of Fossil Fuels, the dinosaur as he calls himself, has certainly been singing from a different hymn sheet to his cabinet colleagues. But I want to bring it and contextualize it, Olivia, into what we're currently experiencing in South Africa at the moment. Just recently, the KZN floods, and you live down in that part of the world, Andrew. I was chatting to a professor from UKZN who, along with two other universities, have conducted a long geological study looking back over 9,000 years and predicting with some degree of certainty that this is going to become more frequent in a warming world. In fact, in a more warm period about 9,000 years ago, these sorts of tropical cyclones were very regular events by studying sediment on the seabed. So we need to start talking, it's happening now. We need to start talking about adaptation, don't we? And I think, you know, when I asked that, it was very interesting to observe HSBC's Global Head of Responsible Investment, Stuart Kirk, at an FT event, and it's gone viral in the climate community, just sort of dismissing offhand the importance of climate change. But I think inadvertently, he gave a lot of the spotlight to adaptation. What is that adaptation going to cost developing countries?
Yeah, that's an amazing point. I mean, I was also following the Stuart Kirk comment. Andrew, you'll laugh. He said that Miami will be 6 feet under.
That's
but
great.
It's not so bad because the Netherlands is the same. and it's funny, but it's also not funny when you look at the type of costs that African countries are currently facing and likely to face going forward. So this was a big issue at COP26 last year. Adaptation finance has always been the kind of underdog when it comes to the provision of finance. We've tended to see flows of around 75% to mitigation because it's fun to finance renewable energy projects which also have co-benefits for the developed world. But the co-benefits for the developing world when it comes to adaptation are far less. It's a very localized benefit. And the volumes have just been very, very dismal. So I think it was in 2019 about $20 billion went to adaptation. But the current needs at the moment on an annual basis are $70 billion. And those are expected to rise to somewhere between $140 and $300 billion by 2030. So we're talking about almost incomprehensible numbers, at least from a consultant's point of view. And we're not really seeing the funds catch up with those figures. So what was agreed to last year was that countries would double their adaptation finance, that was the Glasgow Pact, and we've yet to see new numbers from the OECD on whether that actually is taking place. There tends to be a numbers lag because countries still have to report on what they've provided, and there's still disagreement on what even counts as adaptation finance. So I echo Justine's comment. I mean, what we're seeing in all spaces is there's a big role for business to fill the gap. There's a huge amount of opportunities around green bonds, or resilience bonds, or ways of investing in adaptation that can be mutually beneficial. I know there's been a couple of projects down run by the City of Cape Town. And I think it's up to business to really carry the torch a little bit when it comes to private finance.
Well, if it doesn't, I mean, just on a very practical level, the cost of insuring your plants and equipment and buildings is going to rise. It's going to be astronomical. Already we're seeing insurers raising this as a big issue. And the authors of that study said to me that no one really paid much attention when it was published in March, apart from the insurers and the reinsurers. They were beating down a path to their door. So it just showed you that this is an important issue for business. Justine, I want to come back to this issue of the $8.5 billion that was a pledge, the kind of marquee pledge that was secured at COP26. And then there's this recent paper from the Sustainability Institute, co-authored with the African Development Bank and Professor Mark Swilling, saying that we probably need about $250 billion for South Africa's just energy transition. So it puts that $8.5 billion into perspective. Now, what progress has been made on that $8.5 billion, apart from obviously the president appointing Daniel Manele to project manage it?
So I feel like I'm going to sound a bit like a broken record, but again, things move slowly. I did have contact with somebody who is at the heart of those discussions, and he's confirmed to me that progress is happening. The stakeholders are working well together, but it's a very complicated transaction. And as a lawyer, I do understand that these things take time and people continue with their lives as they try and complete these transactions. So unfortunately, I don't think we are much further than we were in December. Mm. But we can only hope.
It's a, well, I mean, one understands that one has to dot all the I's and cross the T's on this, but the urgency couldn't be more apparent as we go in and out of load shedding. And, you know, to what Mark Swilling has said this week, there is a plan here to potentially end load shedding in 2 years if we can get some level of coordination. And I think the $8.5 billion certainly has a role to play in terms of strengthening the grid in key areas where renewable capacity has already been reached in areas of the Northern Cape and the like. But I want to move on to one of the big tangibles from COP26, unless you just want to respond to that quickly, Justine.
I just wanted to perhaps give some sort of context to the challenges that are associated with the transaction, and one is that it's not 100% clear what the nature of the funding is going to be. So in the South African context, you know, we're not yet sure what the debt is really going to cost us. And it may be that paying that back actually makes sense if it comes from a different lender rather than the governments that are proposing offering it. And the other thing is that I don't think that we necessarily have a solid transition plan which would make any lenders feel particularly comfortable. And that's just in terms of setting out all the projects that the money would go to, etc. And I think in the South African context, it's absolutely critical for us to have clearly defined project of where the money will go to and who will be in charge of it.
The
so
minister
for me, those are significant challenges.
The Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition at the Steel Master Plan conference a couple of weeks ago was asking the steel industry upstream and downstream to submit projects for this $8.5 billion. So it seems like at cabinet level projects are still being agglomerated, and so you'll have a final portfolio that you might be able to then pitch for this. And then there's obviously the mechanism about how those funds will be dispersed, and also on what terms, as you say, very important. Will it be concessional? Andrew, I want to move on to one of the key outcomes of COP26 was the approval of Article 6 of the Paris Agreement rulebook governing carbon markets. Now, before we discuss Article 6, just briefly describe carbon markets. How can they curb global greenhouse gas emissions to fight climate change?
So the idea of applying a market solution is to price greenhouse gas emission reductions in locations where the lowest marginal cost can be achieved. So in short, if you're a very highly developed economy somewhere in Europe, it will be more expensive for you in that economy to pay for. Emission reductions will come at a higher cost in those economies, whereas emission reductions can be achieved at lower cost in other locations. The science underpinning this entire idea is that an emission reduction achieved in one place in the globe is as valuable as an emission reduction achieved in another place in the globe, because we're talking about the global atmosphere. So it's different in that sense from the idea of achieving air quality improvement in one location. So the idea is that the climate change positive contribution occurs no matter where that emission reduction happens. Article 6 is important not because it is primarily to do with the carbon market, although it is to do with the carbon market. Article 6 frames international cooperation under the Paris Agreement to achieve mitigation. That's kind of important because in the carbon market context, under the regime as it existed before Paris, so under the Kyoto Protocol, the idea of the carbon market was that an emission reduction would be achieved in a developing country like South Africa, and that would be, in a sense, offshored to a developed country for the payment of a fee. I am simplifying for effect at the moment. That idea is quite important for us for a number of reasons. One of those reasons is there is the potential to raise carbon finance to support, at least partly support, some of those projects that Justine was talking about. But we've also relied on this idea of the market as an element of the South African carbon tax. That means that a clearer articulation or a clarification of what in fact will happen now under the multilateral regime, so under Paris and under Article 6, is it's high time we had that clarification. And Olivia and I are very lucky to be working with government at the moment around formulating, if you like, assisting with formulating what Article 6 would look like from a South African perspective. And the last point is that's important because Article 6 under the Paris Agreement hands a greater measure of control to national governments as to how those governments go about achieving mitigation and using the market. So how we clarify those rules are important for us.
And I want to get this clear in my own head here. If I'm SAPI and I want to develop on one of my properties, I've got a stream and I want to put a hydroelectric plant in there, and I'm going to be reducing my emissions by X. Under Article 6, I'd be able to raise carbon funding probably at preferential rates over in Europe to fund something like this.
Not at the moment because we're in a transition phase, but in theory, yes, in future. But there's a rather interesting wrinkle that I love. So I love this stuff so much. Is that so? Kind of by default now, because of the nationally determined contribution, all emission reduction potential in the country might actually be regarded by government as falling under the nationally determined contribution. So it raises a very interesting question about the future of the voluntary carbon market, which is the idea that you just expressed in the SAPI context. So SAPI in the past quite confidently would go, I'm going to generate voluntary carbon credits by creating emission reduction, and I'm going to sell them or I'm going to raise funding internationally. That might still pertain in the future, but there's a question now that arises, which is under Article 6 or driven by Article 6, will government seek to claim, at least initially, all of the potential emission reduction in the country and then have project developers pay a fee, jump over certain hurdles that in the past they've not had to jump over?
Lest they be double counting.
Great questions for lawyers.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Well, yes, correct. Correct. No, absolutely. And the term applied, the term of art applied by... Article 6 is the idea of whether an emission reduction has been accorded a corresponding adjustment or not. So if you want to move, if you want to now offshore that carbon credit, let's say, which under the Kyoto system was it wasn't easy, but it was easier. If you want to offshore that carbon credit so that it then counts against an emission reduction obligation that is outside of South Africa, then you're going to need government to give you a formal thumbs up in the form of a corresponding adjustment. And that hasn't happened before in the market.
Wow. But this is why climate consultants exist.
That's why you need it.
It's going to keep you employed for the next century at least. Olivia, when it comes down to loss and damage, I mean, you touched on it earlier. The COP26 deal didn't really include a fund for loss and damage, did it? I mean, there was some talk. How significant is this as we head into COP27?
I think it's going to be one of the key issues, particularly because COP27 is an African COP. And I know Egypt is likely to place it firmly on its agenda for this COP. And it was one of the deal breakers at COP26 last year. So, as you mentioned, the G77 in China said, let's put forward a loss and damage finance facility. And that way we can get funding for losses and damages that are going to be sustained regardless of how much we adapt. So there's this fuzzy line between an acknowledgement that you can only adapt so much, and then you have situations like the floods we saw in Durban where, you know, there's a hard line of climate disaster where you cannot adapt to that type of thing. I mean, homes are destroyed, lives are lost. Building a sea level wall isn't necessarily going to sufficiently adapt countries to those types of impacts. And so countries are looking for money to help them respond to or finance the costs of reducing their losses and damages. That idea was rejected by the US and the EU, Australia as well, and instead what countries agreed to was this thing called the Glasgow Loss and Damage Dialogue, which recently kicked off, I think, about a week ago, and it's going to be a two-year dialogue exploring different financing options, which developing countries are very disappointed about. We've had previous dialogues before that haven't borne much fruit. I think there's a bit more urgency behind this one. It's interesting to see, for example, there have been some symbolic pledges already made to the fund, but I think the lawyers in the room are going to have to be extremely creative.
Wow.
Because recently Canada put out its position, which is representative of most developed countries, is that if they agree to finance this type of thing, are they then acknowledging liability for all climate damages and losses as a result of historic emissions? So it's the legal liability issue that's really tying things up.
Just as we've got 3 minutes to go, I want to go around the table. Have we laid the foundations here for an even bigger and hopefully more punchier COP27? And ultimately, what are the key takeouts of this for businesses and their climate strategies? Justine?
Well, for me, I think that I'd like to think that COP27 is actually going to be more successful, and I don't know whether I'm putting my neck on the line here by saying that I think that the Ukraine situation is going to compel governments to put more emphasis on potential renewables and projects which shift the or improve the energy transition. So I'm hoping that that's going to have a positive effect. I'm also hoping that corporations, and particularly with the drive of ESG and companies being required to take more action in relation to environmental social governance issues, that there might be a greater push from corporations, and that consumers will equally push corporations to do the right thing.
Andrew?
I think the time is right. I agree with that. We can feel the political sea change that's going on because of the Russian scenario. But may I say, there has also been a sea change in the attitude of business to these things since Glasgow, since COP26. Now, there are some questions that one needs to ask about the extent to which businesses purporting to claim or to implement net zero targets, for example, are in fact wedded to that.
Yeah.
But the narrative is different. And I take heart in that, by the way. Last thought, the COPs tend to alternate between substantive and administrative COPs. And given some of the gains that we got out of Glasgow Article 6, it's likely that Sharm el-Sheikh will be an administrative COP, which is about consolidating the gains, the administrative gains made in the previous COP. The one difference that I see is loss and damage, but that's Olivia may have a comment on that.
Well, sadly, Olivia, we don't have time.
I'm sorry.
My director's calling time on the show. There is so much more to talk about. We're going to be running a series of features as we build up to Sharm el-Sheikh and COP27. I'd like to hope that Justine is right, that the war in Ukraine has really refocused and re-energized government to wean themselves off fossil fuels and become politically independent from that kind of power that fossil fuel producers exert around the world. COP27, make your mind up. Justine Sweet from Herbert Smith Freehill, thank you very much for sharing a bit more on the report that you've produced, along with Andrew Gilder and Olivia Rumble, directors at Climate Legal. And just as a concluding thought, I think HSBC's Ian Kirk is really symbolic of the broader problem that we have into COP27. I think many banks and big firms have stalled on reckoning with their climate change impacts for decades because their bottom lines remain unaffected, relatively. And as long as the money is still flowing, HSBC and their ilk don't have to worry about it. But then, if we aren't meant to care about 20 or 30 years down the line, then why do we have retirement funds? Why not live in the moment? Why try to make money, and why even invest it all?